This one works good. That's good. Oh, yeah. Ooh, yeah, well, good God. All right, well, we have a small group. This is the Rehabilitation Committee for the California Council of the Blind. And some of my committee members are here. Nellie's here, Emerson, and Pat LaFrance, and Pat, yeah. Wolf, I'm sorry. And we're honored today to have a specialist talk about vision and eye charts and all those numbers that we... It's sometimes the people who have no vision really don't think anything of, but those with low vision have those numbers, and it's like, well, whatever, I'm just legally blind, whatever, I can't see it anyhow. Well, hopefully we can get this, and I believe this is going to be recorded, if I'm correct. We're kind of in the early stage, so I'm hoping it does get recorded, and it's going to be on the podcast, the CCB radio stream. Yeah, so I'm hoping it's on. Yeah, so it's good. Well, they have the system set up, so we should be okay. Okay, and Dr. Krista Napier is here from Western University School of Optometry, and that university actually houses many other disciplines in the teaching professions of podiatry, dentistry, optometry, and probably a whole lot of other things that I can't list. And oh, see, Christy knows it all. But it's a very good university, and it's a new university, but it's been there a long time. And it's just been the small, and finally they got really growing, and it's just amazing. But it's fortunate that we have a person who also is a professor there, who actually is also in the field in practices there. And she has two students that she brought with us, and she's going to talk about the eye chart and the different aspects of legal blindness. And doctor, if you want to introduce your two students, that'd be great.
Well, thank you all. I'm glad to see so many people here. I'm Kirsten Napier, and I am at Western University. I'm an assistant professor there, and I teach the low vision course. And I also teach in the clinic as well and see patients. And I've probably seen a few of your clients. Is everybody in the room a counselor through Department of Rehab? No. Okay. So, but a few of you are, because Nellie is and Ed is. Who else is a counselor in the room? Pat? Okay. Okay, so a few other people. Great. So it looks like we've got a variety of different interests in the audience. Are the rest of you interested in learning more about eye care and things like that from your own perspective, or because you work with clients that you're interested in learning more about? Oh, great. Okay. Is that pretty similar for the rest of the audience? Okay. It's nice for us to have an idea of, you know, who we're talking to and what you know and what you've experienced and kind of what the what you are interested in learning about, which Ed has shared to me already. I have two students that are with me today. They work with me in the clinic. So today is our low vision clinic afternoon, and we're here instead. So I have Andy No and Sabrina Jakob. Did I say it right, Sabrina Jakob? Okay. And they are both third-year students, so they're getting towards the end of their program. And they're going to do a lot of the presentation with me. With a small, intimate group like this, I think we can have an informal presentation. So if you have questions that come up at any point, feel free to just shout them out. Okay. And we want you to ask your question on the mic. Is that mic working?
Yes.
Okay, good. And then I think we can get started.
Hello. Oh, as introduced before, I'm Andy. I'm a third-year intern at Western University College of Optometry, working with Dr. Napier. So for today, we're going to go through a presentation describing the eye exam and eye exams for the visually impaired. So we're going to explain the types of eye exams, the different types, and we're going to describe the components of the eye exam, which include the visual acuity, the visual field, refraction, and the health evaluation. And in the end, we'll go through some determination of legal blindness. Okay? So for the types of eye exams, we have comprehensive, low vision, contact lens, neuro-optometric, and behavioral. And comprehensive is considered the normal eye exam where we take some pre-testing, check your pupils, check your extraocular muscles and how they function, and we go through a refraction and an eye health assessment, looking at the front and the back of your eyes with dilation. A low vision eye examination could be considered an extension of that comprehensive exam, where we go further and try to determine what type of devices will work for a low vision patient and go through the different options that they have. In a contact lens exam, as far as being included with a comprehensive exam, if a patient wants contact lenses, we try to take a look at the surface of the eye and how a contact lens would work or fit onto that surface, and if it would interact and how they would how their vision would go along with that contact lens. In a neuro-optometric exam, we look at patients with any neurological problems that occur behind the eye, at the optic nerve, in the brain, and try to assess their function and go through rehabilitation in order to try to maximize their available function with that. And in a behavioral or a binocular function eye exam, we look at how a patient's eyes work together, and in order for eyes to work together well, they need to be aligned, and we try to work with their extraocular muscles and try to train those as well as they can to maximize their efficiency. Okay, that was kind of a lot, but I hope you're all following along. Okay, next are the components of the exam. We have visual acuity, visual field, the refraction, binocular function, contrast sensitivity, health exam, and the low vision evaluation, which includes the devices and the tints for lenses. Okay, so first, when you go into an eye exam, the doctors always make you look at this chart, right, to read the letters. What they're trying to do is to measure your visual acuity. And visual acuity can be best simply described as your sharpness of vision. It's the ability to see an image of a certain size and recognize it. So that's what we're trying to get you to do when we're asking you to read the letters that you can read up on that chart. Some history: the Snellen chart, which is the most popular chart that's used to determine visual acuity, was named after the Dutch ophthalmologist Herman Snellen, and it was first developed in 1862. So we use visual acuity to test the different structures of the eye and how they and it helps us measure the damage and follow a disease process, because visual acuity takes in uses a lot of different structures within the eye in order form the image from the cornea in front to the lens and then onto the retina. All of those structures of the eye need to be working together or in harmony to see an image clearly. And the two charts mainly used is the Snellen that I described before that everybody's mostly seen. And there's also another type of visual acuity chart called the LogMAR. And the LogMAR is very similar to a Snellen chart. But the differences is that there are some advantages of using a LogMAR chart over a Snellen chart. In a LogMAR chart, each line has an equal amount of letters. So in a Snellen chart, you'd see one big E on top, and then you know two smaller letters, and then three. Whereas in a LogMAR chart, you would see five big letters on top, and then the next line would have five smaller, and then five smaller, and then keep going down that way so that there would be an equal amount of letters per line. Another advantage would be that there are regular spacing between lines and letters in a LogMAR chart. And the letters also get reduced in size in a linear progression, so in an equally linear progression. And with those advantages over the Snellen, most of the researchers that use visual acuity prefer to use the LogMAR chart over the Snellen chart, even though the Snellen is a lot more popular within eye clinics. Yes, that would be the Snellen chart. The other one is called the LogMAR visual acuity chart.
But what do you see when you look at it?
You would see five, all the lines would have five letters within each line. And you would see five large letters on top, whereas with a Snellen chart, you would only see one E.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, how did they come up with this chart in the first place? How did you know decide the size of the letters and work it down to the smallest letter size? How did they come up with that?
Well, the Snellen chart, Dr. Herman Snellen, the ophthalmologist, he developed the chart just using basically like a standard.
I'm not sure exactly how they decided on the exact numbers. There's been a lot of research into 20/20 because everybody knows the number 20/20, and you know that that's what's considered normal vision. But in actuality, most people that have normal vision and don't have a visual impairment have probably better than 20/20 vision. Because if you can imagine, if 20/20 was the average, a lot of people would feel very bad if they had 20/30 vision, even if that was in the normal range. Does that make sense? So at some point, Dr. Snellen made a chart many, many years ago, 150 years ago. So obviously things have changed quite a bit since he developed the first notation. So his 20/20 notation has stuck, and that's what Andy's going to describe next, is what does 20/20 actually mean in 20/200. But the actual numbers, so I think what they've done is found an average number or average letter size, and then everything else is based on that letter size. And it's simple math to figure out, you know, once you have your standard letter size, to figure out what, you know, if the letter is this big, is that a 20/40 letter, or is that a 20/100 letter? So there's a standard size that's been developed. Part of it is related to the angle of resolution in the eye, which is getting a little bit technical, so tell me if it's too technical. But there's a minimum angle size, so you can measure, just like in geometry, you can measure the angle of triangles. Well, you can measure the angle between the size of the letter and when it comes to a point on the retina, and so that's part of how they decide how big or how small the letter is going to be. A question?
Just that, do they also consider the, not just the size, but the thickness of the font and the spacing of the fonts? Is that part of it, or is
yeah.
that something that's come along later?
It is. That's a great question, because those of you that can read print know that different fonts look very different. And so a different font size will be a very different thickness, a different height, and things like that, different shape, exactly. So there has been a lot of research going into it, which is partially why the LogMAR system is considered to be superior from a research perspective to Snellen, because the letters are much more standardized. The Snellen letters are, they're more standardized than not, but they're not perfectly standardized. So there's been a lot of people that have looked at using specific letters, specific size and shape, font size of letters. So most Snellen charts use more of a block size letter, and a lot of them will favor some letters over others, which is why for those of you that can read some of the letters on the chart, you notice that you might be saying the same letter again and again. There's a lot of E's, there's a lot of V's, as in Victor. There are a lot of repetitive letters because those have been shown to be very reliable. People don't mix those up as often. Back to Andy.
Thank you, Dr. Napier. And continuing on with visual acuity, I have a little question. Does anybody know what 2020 means?
I was told that it means you see at 20 feet what someone with normal vision should see at 20 feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, at 20 feet, a person should see this little about 8.5 millimeter size, 8 inch,
8 inch.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, about an 8.5 millimeter size letter at 20 feet away.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Centimeters.
8.5 centimeters, I mean, not millimeters. That's a little bit more. In inches, that would be about 3.5 inches, three and three quarters. Yeah, a little less than 4 inches at 20 feet away. And so In the progression of the visual acuity chart, 2030, 2040, 2050, the letters get larger. And as the letters get larger, a normal person should be able to see them further away. So at the big E is 2400. And based on that number, it's 20 times larger than a 2020 letter. Mm-hmm. And so that would be about, what? Yeah. All right, so.
170.
So it's about 170 centimeters large. At 2400. So a person with normal vision should see that letter 400 feet away. Yeah. And but a person that only sees 2400 only sees that 20 feet away. And so the difference between 2020 versus 2200 would be 10 times. And a normal person should see that letter at 200 feet away, where a person with actual 2200 vision only sees it at 20 feet away. Okay, and that's describing visual acuity. And next we have the visual field. And the visual field can be described as the extent and quality of peripheral vision. So the ability to detect an image on the side of your fixation. So when you're looking straight ahead, anything that comes from the side, how well you are able to detect that stimulus. And why we test for the visual field, test for the intactness of the peripheral retina and the corresponding brain centers. So in the back of your eye, you have your retina, and in the middle of your retina, where you, in your central vision, is called the fovea. And in the fovea is your central vision, so anything you're looking straight directly at, that's you're looking at the fovea. But your other peripheral retina, so around outside of the fovea, that part of your eye sees your peripheral vision. So anything that... Yes, question?
What is the difference then between fovea and macula?
It's the same region.
The macula is within
The macula. And then the peripheral retina, yes. And so anything that falls into the side of your vision will fall within the peripheral retina or the... And in disease of the retina, where a portion of the peripheral retina is no longer working, then you'll have the loss of vision in that particular area, or if it's diffuse, then your vision will gradually decrease until you only have central vision. And then and with disease progression, you'll lose everything eventually. In such cases like glaucoma. And as far as how we test for the visual field, we use confrontational fields, a tangent screen, or automated perimetry. With confrontational fields is when the doctor asks if you see my fingers come in, say yes. We'll bring the hand from outside of your peripheral vision to just the outer limit, and when the patient says that they can first see it, they say yes. That would be a confrontational field. Another variation of that would be showing numbers of fingers and asking a patient to count or add up how many fingers they see, and that checks for any spots or quadrants that are missing in a patient's vision. With a tangent screen, it's basically a big board on the wall where a patient would look at the center with one eye, with an end that the patient can see will be gradually brought in until the patient can see the end of the stick. And lastly, we have automated perimetry, which is the big dome, concave dome that a patient sits in front of, with a little target in the center. And in this test, one eye is being tested at a time, and the patient is given a button to press whenever a light stimulus is seen. And during this whole time, the patient's eyes is kept at the target in the center. And then when the test is started, a computer shines the light inside the dome, and then whenever the patient sees a light, the patient will click the button. And then, based on the responses, the computer automatically maps and calculates the visual field. Mm-hmm. All right, and when the visual field test is finished, it'll give you a certain printout or readout of the patient's visual field. And in reading it, the extent of the field corresponds to visual functioning. So obviously you want as large of a field as you can get. That means that the retina is intact. There's no breaks or anything suspicious going on. But if there is any sense or any indication of field loss, it can mean certain disease states. Like glaucoma, you would see gradually increasing visual field loss from the outside to inside. And other opacities that can occur in the eye can result in visual field loss as well, like any pigmentation on the lens or any increased floaters and stuff like that. So after visual acuity and visual fields, we have refraction, which is the process where we try to get a working prescription for your eye. And in refraction, we use different sorts of lenses, and in the course of the refraction, we're trying to get the best combination of lenses that will allow for the best vision. There's certain eyes that can be found, so eye conditions with refraction, such as hyperopia, myopia, and presbyopia. Hyperopia is commonly termed as farsightedness. It basically means that you have a short eye, and in order for the light to be focused onto your retina or your fovea, the eye has to accommodate or make its inside lens focus more. So that's why the prescription is a plus prescription. Yes.
Why, as people get older, then do they get farsighted? Is their eye actually changing shape?
When a person gets older, it's not that the eye is changing its shape. It's that as you age, the lens inside your eye, yeah, stops working, and that's why you need a higher plus prescription. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yep, that's why you need the plus. With farsighted, you need a plus lens in order to focus the light onto the retina, because if the eye is too short, then the actual focus is set behind the eye. So with the plus lens, you're setting the focus closer, bringing it closer so that it lends more towards the retina. And in myopia, which is nearsightedness, commonly termed as nearsightedness, the eye is longer than where the light is focused. So in that case, we use minus lenses to diverge the light and make it fall further back onto the retina. And for many myopic patients, they need glasses for far away, but they're fine for near. And the last condition would be, the last in this list would be presbyopia, which is the lack of accommodation. And in young people, the lens inside of your eye usually increases its size so that it can focus the light onto the retina, And as a person ages, this ability to change the shape of the lens decreases. And that's why as we get older, like typically into your 40s, that ability to accommodate decreases, and a person would need an add or a plus or further increased plus to be able to read letters at near. And through the refraction, when a refraction is starting, we have certain starting points that we look at. Usually a patient's previous lens prescription is a pretty good starting point. But if we don't have that, there are a number of other ways that number of other techniques that we use to find a starting point, which is one would be retinoscopy. And that's when we shine the light, shine a certain a beam of light into the eye, and check the reflex. And in looking at the reflex, we insert lenses in front, and based on how the light reacts to those lenses, we have a starting point. Another start point would be use autorefractor. And an autorefractor is a machine that that shines that takes a reading of your eye and tries to get the best prescription or best estimate of your eye. Yes, question in the back. Albinism.
I have albinism, and I was wondering, do you know any information on how come they can't make my vision past 2200? No matter what they do, they can't improve it to any better. Is there the reason? I don't understand. Totally.
Sure. There's a couple of reasons why patients with albinism have poor vision. The biggest reason is because of the lack of pigmentation in your body because of albinism. There's not enough pigmentation in the retina. So, and we talked about how the macula is the very center of your vision, and the fovea is in the smallest part of the center of that. There are pigmented tissue that is around it that helps support the function of the macula. So with having the lack of pigmentation, it just makes it so that the macula doesn't function properly. So we can see that the macula is a little bit thinner because it just doesn't have that pigmented tissue, so it doesn't send the neurological signals back the way that it does with somebody who does not have albinism. So that's one reason. Partially because of that, a lot of people with albinism have a nystagmus where their eyes shake, and that's very, very common in albinism. It's also common in a lot of other visual impairments. So you might also know people that don't have albinism but have eyes that shake. And the shaking also will degrade someone's vision. It makes it so that your vision can't be 20/20 because your eye never stops to fixate on something for a long enough time to help that part of the eye and the brain develop. So the question was, is that hard to test, and does it affect the results of the test? And yes, it does. So that makes it so that people that have visual impairments because of albinism and or because of nystagmus probably won't have measurably as good a vision as a normal person. So they won't have 20/20 vision. Usually because of just nystagmus alone, people's vision is around 20/80, 20/60 to 20/100 range. And people that have albinism have around 20/200. So if you have albinism and nystagmus, which is very common, it's usually 20/200 to 20/400. So those of you that work with people and see the reports, so the Department of Rehab counselors probably notice that a lot of people with albinism are very consistently in that range. Answer your question? Okay.
All right, continuing on with the refraction. At the end of the refraction, the doctor will usually have a working prescription for the patient. And in the prescription, there are three components called the sphere, the cylinder, and the axis. The first part of the prescription is called the sphere, which is either a plus or a minus lens, and which tells you whether or not the patient is hyperopic or myopic. The second part of the prescription is called the cylinder, and it's usually a minus cylinder. And what a cylinder tells a person is that a person has astigmatism, where the front surface of the eye is not completely circular, like the surface of a basketball, but more shaped like a football, where there's two different curvatures on the surface of the cornea. And because of that, because of the difference in the curvature, there needs to be two different types of curvature surface on the lens in order to correct it. And the last number is called the axis, and the axis corresponds to the angle at which the cylinder is occurring at. So if you have astigmatism at 90 degrees, which is straight up and down, that's where the axis will be prescribed at in order to provide the best correction for the patient. Is there a question?
Is it all right with you to bring up a personal eye condition?
Yeah, sure.
I'm wondering, I see double so often, and in order to focus on something, I have to close one eye or the other. Is that part of a refraction problem? What would that be caused by?
So the question is why does someone see double? And they have to close one eye in order to not see double. So probably it's hard to say why it's happening, because there's a lot of different reasons that someone could see double. But what's functionally happening is that your eyes are not lined up at the right place. So one eye is seeing one thing, and the other eye is seeing something different. And usually they're pretty close. If it's not very close, then your brain tunes out, and it will just ignore one eye. So you're probably seeing images that look kind of overlapping. And that's very disconcerting for people. So if you cover one eye, you just remove one of those images, which is why you single them if you cover one eye. And Andy's now going to talk about binocular function, which is exactly that, when we're looking to see how well the eyes line up. Because if they don't line up properly, you might either have double vision or your brain is not perceiving the image from one eye. So you're only getting one eye's input to the brain. Mm-hmm.
One eye for nearsighted and the other eye for farsighted. Mm-hmm. And I wonder now, could that be any part of it?
No, it's very unlikely that that's part of it. That's a very common way of using contact lenses for people that do need that near prescription because of presbyopia. It's called monovision. So we correct one eye for far away and one eye for up close. So that in itself makes your eyes work separately. But it doesn't cause you to have double vision when you remove the contacts. People might have a very brief episode of double vision immediately after removing the contacts, but then the brain and the eyes figure out, oh, okay, now I'm working together. So that's probably not why you have the double vision, but I'm not sure why you do.
All right, thank you. That question was actually a really good segue into binocular function. So as we all know, as humans, we have two eyes. In order to see well, we need to have the two eyes working together well. And there are some advantages to having two eyes. It gives a spare eye in case one is really damaged. Having two eyes gives you a wider field of view. Third, with two eyes, you can have binocular summation, so that the ability to detect faint objects is increased when you have two eyes working together. And lastly, it can give stereopsis, or otherwise known as 3D vision, yeah, depth perception. Yes, it is. And so with stereopsis, it's important to have stereopsis so that a person can see depth perception, a person can judge how far things are away from them, so that, you know, if something's coming at you, you know when to dodge, and or something. Exactly. There you go. And some conditions that you need for good stereopsis is that your eyes need to be lined up really well. You need visual acuity that's very close to each other, so not like 20/50 and 21/50. More closer, you know, like 20/30, 20/40, 20/20, 20/30. The images fall onto the retina, and being interpreted by the brain can be properly integrated. So that, because if the two images aren't close to each other in terms of acuity and sharpness, then the brain will have to choose between which image to look at, and it'll choose the one that's usually more clear. And while in that case you'll see single vision, you won't have depth perception. Other aspects of binocular function is called phoria, tropias, or anatropias. In the case of phorias, a phoria is basically how the eye likes to rest in its resting position. So, for example, if you close your eyes won't look at where you last looked, but rather it'll move to a position where it likes to stay. There are tests that we use to check for the phoria, and one test we use is to insert vertical prism, and that makes two images one on top of the other. And when a person is looking at those two images, usually a person with a phoria will have those two images more left and right. So there'd be one image on the top left, there'd be one image on the bottom right. And in order to test it, we move the prism. We add some prism so that the images will line up with each other. And when those images are lined up, we take the reading of the prism and we get a measurement of the phoria.
Yeah, so basically what we do is we trick the eyes. So we want the eyes to work together, but we force them to work independently of each other. And there's a number of different tests that we can do. So Andy described one of the common tests. But sometimes we can put a different colored lens in front of the eye, and that will force the eyes to work independently. We can even just wave our hands back and forth and watch how the eyes move. And that will give us an idea of if they will kind of have a different position from each other. So there's a lot of ways we could trick your eyes to learn a lot of information.
Is that how they do the 3D glasses, like when you go to Disneyland, which I can't really tell?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what they do? They trick the eye with colored lenses, maybe?
Exactly. So they can use a couple different things, either colored lenses or what we call polarized lenses. So what...
any of you that have been to a 3D movie that have some usable vision noticed is that you probably don't see it in 3D, but you see it better with the glasses on than off. Because what they do is they make it so that one eye is seeing one image and the other eye is seeing something that's slightly off center, so that when someone who has good binocular vision looks with both eyes, they see things coming out at them or be recessed into it, because it just tricks the eyes into seeing things separately. But what happens is that most people that have visual impairments, because they meet enough of the criteria, or they don't meet enough of the criteria to have good binocular vision, a lot of people that are visually impaired have very poor depth perception, because the eyes just don't have all the components to work together.
And next we have atropia, or otherwise known as strabismus. It's when it's a condition in which the eyes are not properly aligned with each other, and commonly it involves the lack of coordination between extraocular eye muscles, and that prevents the eyes from aligning together, and it prevents proper binocular vision, which also affects your depth perception. So usually with the strabismus, one eye is either turned too much in or turned too much out, and usually patients only use one eye at a time. And how they're treated is with lenses that have prism in it. And when you add prism into the lenses, it can bring the image to where the pupil is, and to bring the eyes the images closer to together, so that the brain can integrate them. Yes, question.
Are patients with strabismus treated with surgery?
Yes, they can be treated with surgery. But I don't know if this is correct, but with surgery, usually this ophthalmologist or surgeon will try to correct it to... it's more of a cosmetic correction. And you can still have a little bit of strabismus remaining from that surgery. Do you have anything?
It depends on a lot of different factors on how well the strabismus surgery will work. Strabismus surgery is very hard to do, because the outcome, almost always, people will not be perfectly lined up. So what's very common is for people to have many strabismus surgeries. So they might say, oh, I've had 4 surgeries to straighten my eyes, because it's very hard to get them very well lined up. And what the end result is that the patient oftentimes will not have good binocular vision even afterwards, because the brain has just been set to a different system. But if it's done at a young age, there's a higher likelihood of having a better outcome. Unless it's just too far apart, the eyes are too far apart, and then it's mostly for cosmetic reasons. But cosmetic reasons are a very good reason to do surgery. I have had a patient who, you know, cried to me that she couldn't get a job because people thought she looked funny. Cosmetic reasons for doing surgery are not always just to make it so that someone looks better, but so that they can function better in society. So the question is that also what is called lazy eye or wandering eye? And yeah, there's a few different ways of defining what lazy eye is, but wandering eye is an eye turn or a strabismus. That's the same thing. Some people will call a lazy eye. Some eyes, for different reasons, don't develop very well from birth, even though they don't have any disease. It's the way that the eye has developed for a number of different reasons. And that sometimes is called a lazy eye too. And both of these conditions can be treated with different kinds of lenses or therapy. So, and that's why we're talking about them today, because you might find them in some of your visually impaired patients might have some of these conditions as well.
Okay. Wow.
Go ahead.
These eye conditions that we're discussing today, I'm wondering, do you have a ballpark where you can work with the eye that after a certain point the brain doesn't adjust, or because I know that there's conditions that where, you know, the brain will make it all work out. Mm-hmm. Do you understand what I'm asking you? It adjusts to differences and difficulties with the eye.
Yeah, so the brain is a vital component to all of the eye testing that we do. Because whenever we're doing any testing, we're testing not only how the eye works, but how it sends information to the brain and therefore how well the brain works. Our brains are very smart. That's why we like them as humans. And so they're very well able to figure out when there's a problem and try to correct it on its own, which is sometimes why people will have an eye that doesn't, you know, a lazy eye, which doesn't see very well. And some people with eye turns, they'll just ignore one eye because the brain figures out this is too weird to see two separate images. I'm just going to ignore that one that's farther away. So the brain is very good at correcting itself on some things, but sometimes it doesn't correct itself properly, and that's where we can intervene and kind of encourage it to go back to a better state of improvement.
Okay, yeah. So that's pretty much it for my section. Next, thank you. Next, my colleague Sabrina here will continue on with the rest of the presentation.
Okay, I'm going to begin by going over contrast sensitivity. And what contrast sensitivity basically is it allows us to see objects when they're in a certain background. Sometimes it's harder to see an object when it blends in with the background, and sometimes it may be a lot easier. So that's why it's important to have good contrast sensitivity in order to see it. And a specific chart is used that determines how well your eyes function in low light settings and how well you can distinguish the objects from similarly colored or from shaded backgrounds. Usually when we're doing the visual acuity test and we're using the Snellen chart, it's a high contrast eye chart that's used, and there's big black letters, numbers, or shapes that are sharply displayed against a white background, so it makes it a lot easier to see. However, in the real world, there's a lot more shades of gray, and it's not always as easy to see something. That's why it's important to have good contrast sensitivity. And when someone has poor contrast sensitivity, it'll be hard to see those different shades of gray, and especially when there's different light settings. It's very possible a lot of times to have 20/20 vision but have poor contrast sensitivity, which is why it's important to test for that. And sometimes someone with poor contrast sensitivity loses a lot of the object's definition because they can't really see it in a given background. And some of these symptoms that these people could have is difficulty driving at night. It makes it a lot harder to see, especially the gray curbs, and it may even be hard to see a pedestrian walking on those curbs, which is definitely not a good thing. And reading the newspaper is another thing that can become difficult because of the gray shading that's used. And in general, people with poor contrast sensitivity notice eyes getting a lot more tired when they're reading or watching TV or doing near work. Low contrast sensitivity can be associated with such eye conditions such as glaucoma, diabetic retinopathy, or cataracts. And it can also be associated with side effects of laser vision surgery. Contrast sensitivity charts determine your ability to see objects in relation to the size and contrast. So if you're given a small object, you can only see it when the contrast is very high. Whereas with a larger object, it'll be easy to see it even if the contrast is low. So when you're tested for it, there's different sizes and colors that are used. And it's also tested under varying conditions such as glare or with lower light settings. And someone with good contrast sensitivity can see an object even when it's under very low contrast, and they'll be able to distinguish it. And these test results help determine if you need specialized lenses or improved lighting to help with your contrast sensitivity. There's eyewear that uses specialty tinted lenses, and these lenses could have a yellow filter in them, and that increases the brightness of an object in comparison to its background and allows for the person to see it a lot easier. The light transmission is altered by this filter,
and it reduces some of the aberrations and it increases the brightness perception. However, there's some limitations with using these tints, and there are certain diseases where they're not able to be used, but for the most part, most patients are able to use the tints if they have poor contrast sensitivity. Is there any questions about contrast sensitivity? Yes.
If a person has contrast sensitivity but doesn't see reds and yellows well because of other challenges, are there tints that would work for those folks?
It really depends on a number of different things. Some people have poor ability to see red, like determining between red and green. That's a very common color deficiency, which is not specifically related to visual impairment at all. It's a genetic thing. If your mom has it, you probably are going to have it too. And tints will not help for that because that's a deficiency within the way that the retinal cells in the brain work together to see those colors. But if it's because of a disease process, then it's common that sometimes we can use either tints that will highlight the reds to make it stand out a little bit more or filter down some of the other colors. And so that's what we'll do when we do a tint assessment. We look at what are the colors that somebody might have problems with. Oftentimes people don't have specific colors, they won't be able to say, oh, I have trouble with reds and oranges. And then the tint assessment will just be more looking at subjective preference. Is there another question?
Retinopathy of prematurity, and although if things aren't too busy, I don't see the details of a lot of things, mm-hmm. but like light and dark and stuff, I can usually see that, at least with one eye now still, after cataract surgery and such. But as much as I can get around and figure things out, what's going on with, for example, I almost ran into a small plane. Cessnas and stuff? Mm-hmm. It was sitting under a tree where the shadows were, the light come through the tree branches. I absolutely couldn't even pick up the shape of the plane and almost ran into a wing. It was stationary, all that.
That's good.
But, yeah, I know. But what was going on there?
Well, it's probably because your contrast sensitivity is low. Okay. So that means that, measurably when we would test it, we would find that you need there to be a very high level of contrast between colors to see them well. So you need more of a black on white than a gray on white or a gray on black.
So I couldn't actually, with all the busyness of the different mm-hmm. light and dark, I couldn't actually pick out the plane then. From the other, the ground and everything else that was light and dark.
Right, right, exactly.
I couldn't pick out the shape. That's probably why I have orange lenses for both for sunglasses.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I have a reading lens mm-hmm. that's got orange in it. So although I use a lot of light, it takes the glare out and it shows contrast a lot.
Right.
For reading. Okay, mm-hmm. thanks.
Exactly.
Oh, is there another question? Yeah. Sure.
Okay. I'm partially sighted, and I also volunteer for some things in CCB that ask the question, is this person legally blind or not, yes or no? And it sounds like there's a lot of things other than whether they're 2200 or not that we have to take into consideration, and there really isn't any easy way to do that. And the other thing is that for some of the government things, I know paratransit is doing it already, it's not whether you're legally blind or not, it's a functional issue. So two people could be 2200 and one of them could get around really well and, why do you need paratransit? And the other couldn't find their way out of a paper bag, so yeah, you get to use that as services. And I guess I'm a little worried that with the government funding as it is, that some of us who are now partially sighted and eligible for things like Social Security might not be. I wonder what you as optometrists think of this functional issue.
Yeah, that's a very tricky question. Well, and we share your concerns because there's a lot of the levels that the government uses for legal blindness were set in the 1930s, and it was set, I don't want to say arbitrarily, because they did have some reasons for doing it, but they did leave out a lot of different things. And also the Department of Motor Vehicles is another organization that looks at only specific criteria, and they don't think about a lot of these other criteria that might affect people, people's functioning. From my perspective, I look at all of my visually impaired patients at their function. So I look at how is it that you're functioning with whatever vision you have. And I do find that's why we bring up the example that someone can have 20/20 vision, but if their contrast is reduced because of a condition, cataract is one of the biggest conditions, they can be unsafe on the road, they can have trouble reading things. So it brings up a much bigger issue that larger governmental organizations have not even begun to address. So it's something that I think is what we all have to do, is we need to be the ones to recognize that someone might have problems that don't fit under the you know, specific criteria that organizations set, and then figure out how to deal with them and make improve their functioning.
Hi, I have a question about a condition that my daughter developed. Mm-hmm. And she was driving, and there was a yellow car in front of her, and all of a sudden she didn't see it out of the center of her eye. So she realized that she had this hole in her central vision. So she went to the doctor, and he gave her some kind of expensive eye drops that didn't do anything and told her, oh, let's wait and see what happens. Well, she finally got sent to a specialist who found out that they said it was some condition that affects older people, but they've seen it in people as young as 17. And they gave her a choice of a couple of different shots, and they settled on the Avastin shot for the blood vessels or something. Mm-hmm. They had said that maybe she had a bleed behind her eye. And so her vision went from 2200 to 2050.
Wow.
And then she got another shot. And so I'm just trying to kind of, I wonder what it is, because she doesn't know.
Mm-hmm. So are you wondering what the shot might have been, or?
No, I know what the shot was.
What the condition is.
The shot, it was to shrink the blood vessels, mm-hmm, down. And they said it won't happen again in this eye. However, she has a scarring, but it could happen in her other eye.
Mm-hmm.
And is this kind of like a macular thing, maybe?
Yeah, it sounds like it's probably a macular problem. It's hard for me to say exactly what it, mm-hmm, is, because there's a number of different macular problems that can cause bleeding behind, you know, the back of the eye, the retina, and Avastin is one of the few different kinds of treatments that they'll use for it. It's a very good treatment, and it's, you know, this is a very good example of scientific research working well quickly to help problems like bleeding in the back of the eye. But she's at very young age, so it's probably,
yeah,
you know,
She's 29.
Yeah, and if it happened when she was, I mean, even at 29, it's still young for,
yeah,
these kind of conditions to happen. So there's a few conditions that would happen in someone at that age. It's probably what they're looking at, is that she might have one of those types of conditions.
Yeah, well, they said whatever she has usually happens to people older.
Mm-hmm.
But now the concern is the insurance is dropped because she only has so many visits,
mm-hmm,
and she's lost that, and now she has no way of getting all this measurement done to see if her eye is better, getting better, or if she needs another shot.
Mm.
Well, do you guys do that?
We can certainly evaluate her. On our faculty right now, there is no one that's able to do the injections, but we could monitor and evaluate if she needed the injections. A lot of times there's a lot of monitoring in between just to the point of needing the injections. So, and we could certainly do that at our location, and we have a lot of different programs for people that don't have insurance or are under unique situations. And then if we decide that she does need a shot, we have some other doctors that we work with people that have no insurance or lower income or things like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. While you're looking at paperwork, I understand that the legal blindness numbering system internationally, it's at 2400 or something like that. And is that correct, or is that? And then, what is happening with the United States? Are we moving away from the 2200 and going to a higher number, to maybe 2300 or something?
Sabrina, that's actually what we just talked about, is that that's what she's going to talk about next, is legal blindness criteria. But Sabrina, I'm going to answer your question a little bit more specifically if it's changing, and then Sabrina will talk about what the criteria is. It's not, to my knowledge, I have not heard anyone talk about changing the level. The two different organizations, or two different groups, that many different groups look at, what, you know, the levels of visual impairment, what, when it's legally blind and things like that. But within the U.S., 2200 is the rule, and Sabrina will tell you about some of the nuances of that and why that's not always the case. But it's actually that it's made it a lower criteria. So it's, you can have better vision and still be legally blind in the U.S. In the world, it's set at 2400, and the World Health Organization is looking at changing their criteria a bit to be more descriptive, instead of that you are either legally blind or not legally blind. So they're looking at having different levels of visual impairment. So like a range, maybe you're 2050 to 2100, and then 2100 to 200, or I'm not sure exactly of what numbers they're using. And the World Health Organization looks at it from a different perspective than the U.S. The U.S., we know it's the Social Security Act, so it was because the government decided, hey, these people that are visually impaired, we might want to compensate them for having, you know, a condition that causes them to not see very well. In the world, they look at it mostly for statistical purposes, to figure out how many people are blind in the world. Are there some countries that have higher levels of blindness? Are there some countries that we need to, that the world in general needs to help out because of their levels of blindness? So that's really the difference between the two. But I don't think anything is changing majorly in the U.S. It's just the little nuances of the definition have been clarified, because things have changed since 1935. A little bit.
Okay, so I'm going to go over legal blindness. I know you're anxiously awaiting this topic. So blindness is the condition of lacking visual perception due to physiological or neurological factors. And there are various levels to describe the extent of vision loss and define blindness. So it's not just simply a loss of visual acuity. Total blindness is the complete lack of form and visual light perception, and it is recorded as having no light perception at all. And blindness is used to describe severe visual impairment. And in order to determine who may need special assistance because of their disabilities, there's various governmental jurisdictions that have been created to elaborate on the definitions of legal blindness. So in the U.S., legal blindness is defined as having best corrected visual acuity of 2200 or worse in the better seeing eye, and that is with their corrective glasses on. And I know you went over this earlier, but what this basically means is a legally blind individual would have to stand 20 feet from an object in order to see it with as much clarity as someone with normal vision who could see it at 200 feet. And then if the chart being used to assess the visual acuity has letters between 2100 to 2200, then legal blindness is defined as vision worse than 2100. And
Legal blindness can also be defined as having peripheral vision loss of less than 20 degrees in both eyes. Low vision, which is not legal blindness in the United States, is generally considered to have best corrected visual acuity of 20/70 to 20/100. And it is defined as such because most people with low vision won't be able to get an unrestricted driver's license. Then the World Health Organization, they define it a little bit differently. And what the World Health Organization is that it's an agency of the United Nations, and it acts according to, it has authority on over international public health. So legal blindness, as defined by the World Health Organization, is best corrected visual acuity of 20/400 or worse in the better seeing eye with glasses on. And it is defined as peripheral vision loss of less than 10 degrees in both eyes. Yes?
You say for field loss, 20 degrees or less, missing the peripheral. How do they deal with a condition such as Stargardt's, where it's kind of all over the place?
Dr. Napier is going to answer.
Yeah. So there's, and these are the small nuances of legal blindness. So there's, no, that's okay. There, according to the Social Security, there are three ways that somebody can be considered legally blind. They can have visual acuity of worse than, I use worse than 20/100, because every chart that I have in my clinic will measure between 20/100 and 200. So that means that if somebody sees 20/150 in both eyes, they're legally blind. That makes sense? So it's worse than 20/100. And that's something that a lot of people get confused on, because the main text says 20/200 or worse. It's, when you go into the definition of it, that it talks about the charts, because it's based on the old Snellen charts where there was a 100 and a 200 and a 400. But now many charts measure between that. So that's number one. Number two is the visual field, which is 20 degrees in the better eye, basically. And then the third part is called visual efficiency. And what that does is it takes, there's a mathematical formula that you can use to take into account the visual acuity and the visual field to see if the combined loss of both of them, even if neither of those two meets the criteria, if the combined loss meets a specific criteria, then that will count as visual impairment, as legal blindness as well. The trouble with it, though, is that it has to be, the vision, both criteria have to be really, really close to the cutoff in order to qualify under visual efficiency. So you might need to have, maybe you've got 20/100 vision in both eyes and your visual field is 25 degrees. So you're just about on the cusp on either level. So not a lot of people meet that visual efficiency criteria because they probably have met one of the other two. So you had a second follow-up question? Okay,
and then according to the World Health Organization, low vision is defined as having best corrected visual acuity of 20/70 or worse in the better seeing eye and with the glasses on. And also it would be a peripheral visual field loss of less than 20 degrees. The definitions of legal blindness and low vision determined in the United States were done according to how Social Security benefits would be distributed. And in practice, the visual impairment codes are used for insurance purposes. And the World Health Organization has currently been considering revising their criteria to have 5 levels of visual impairment, including patients with uncorrected refractive error who have limited vision simply because they don't have the appropriate correction. And, yes, exactly. And these levels for the World Health Organization were determined for statistical purposes. And benefits are given to people who are considered to be legally blind in the United States, and it's done under 2 programs. There's the Social Security Disability Insurance Program and the Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, program. So even if your vision does not meet the legal blindness definition, you may still be able to qualify for some of these benefits. For Social Security benefits, you must have worked long enough in a job where you have paid Social Security taxes in order to receive these benefits. And then for the SSI program, payments are based on the disability and the blindness, and it doesn't matter whether or not you have worked or not. However, it is based on the income and resources that you have, and it must be under a certain dollar limit. Visual impairment is the consequence of a functional loss of vision rather than eye disorder itself. Eye disorders which can lead to visual impairments include retinal degeneration, albinism, cataracts, glaucoma, corneal disorders, congenital disorders, and much more. Visual impairment can also be due to brain and nervous disorders, and in this case they would be called cortical visual impairment. Visual impairment can also be classified based on how it affects your activities of daily living. This can include cooking, cleaning, self-care, finances, and ambulating at home and away from home. And with severe visual impairment, usually there's going to be a need for total assistance and complete dependency, whereas someone who has less severe of a visual impairment, they may be a little more independent and be able to function a lot more on their own. Complete blindness is having no vision at all or no light perception. And these people are legally blind no matter who determines it and what level it's at. Yes, exactly. Certain myths about blindness that I wanted to quickly go over. Legal blindness is not necessarily complete blindness. You can still have some vision or light perception, but it can be to other factors as we discussed earlier. And legal blindness is impairment in both eyes. Again, the levels were determined by the best seeing eye, so obviously the other eye must be equal or worse than that. And legal blindness can only be determined with the patient's habitual correction or their glasses on. And some of the statistics about visual impairment. In the United States, there's about 1 million Americans over the age of 40 who are legally blind. And about 2.3 million Americans over the age of 40 who are visually impaired. And there's about 57,000 legally blind kids under the age of 21. Worldwide, there is about 37 million people that are blind and about 124 million people with low vision. There is 1.4 million kids under the age of 15 that are blind worldwide. Cataracts are the leading cause of blindness. Formerly, it was trachoma, which is an infection of the eye, but now with the advancement in medicine, it's been able to be treated better, so currently cataracts are the number one reason of blindness. And these statistics that I presented to you, they don't include the 153 million people with uncorrected refractive error, which most of it is avoidable as they might not have access to this correction. Break the glasses or any other sort of correction. Okay, is there a question? Any questions?
Where does macular degeneration fall in the statistics?
In the world statistics, I'm not entirely sure. I'd have to go look up to see, where exactly the levels are at. The world statistics, because there are so many more developing countries and so many more people in those countries than in the U.S., that's why the highest level of visual impairment in the world is cataracts. Right, whereas in the United States, it's very low. And cataract surgery in the U.S. is one of the most commonly done surgeries because everybody gets a cataract at some point if you live long enough. Right, but in the world, it's a big problem because people don't have access to cataract surgery or finances for it or things like that. So the world numbers and how many people have each condition are quite a bit different than in the United States. In the U.S., depending on who you talk to and where they get their information from, macular degeneration is the number one cause of visual impairment. It is for sure in people over age 75. It's by far the number one cause of visual impairment. Under that age, it's close to neck and neck with diabetic retinopathy, because diabetic retinopathy usually can affect people at a younger age than macular degeneration. And there's, of course, exceptions to all of these rules, as Christy pointed out. So macular degeneration is one of, whatever numbers you use, it's one of the leading causes of visual impairment and legal blindness. But the great thing about, well, great, I guess is a relative word, The advancements in treatment for macular degeneration are probably going to lower that number, because now there's not going to be as many people that are legally blind from macular degeneration, but the treatments still most of the time leave people with some kind of an impairment, so they're probably going to be in the low vision numbers. So time will tell, you know, with the changes in treatment, how much that's going to impact the functional effect of macular degeneration than what it is currently. So the question was if diabetic retinopathy is going to increase or decrease, or what's going to happen. Because diabetes itself is on the rise and obesity is on the rise, so the obesity is highly linked to diabetes, so that is also going to contribute to diabetes increasing. Probably people becoming visually impaired from diabetic retinopathy is also increasing. With treatment, most people can be treated with diabetes and not be, in many cases, they can avoid being completely blind, but certainly avoid being legally blind as well. And again, they might be in that gray zone where they have a visual impairment, but they're not quite legally blind. But a lot of times it goes undetected until somebody loses vision permanently, which is really unfortunate that that happens in our country, but it does. Is that another question? A couple questions. Come on, Ed. He's getting tired.
Poor guy. Two questions. One is quick. Avastin, is this the first that I've heard that it's used for treating issues with the circulation in the eye? Mm-hmm. Can that be used to treat macular degeneration?
So Avastin, you may have heard of it because it's actually a cancer drug. So it's used to treat specific kinds of cancer. The component is called anti-VEGF, and VEGF is vascular endothelial growth factor. So what Avastin does is it stops the blood circulation for cancers in the eye. It stops the blood circulation when it's happening because of something like macular degeneration, and possibly even for diabetic retinopathy. It's being looked at for different kinds of diabetic complications too. There are other drugs so Avastin is still currently not FDA approved for use in the eye because there are other medications that are very similar, almost the exact same structure, that are approved for use in the eye. Yes, Lucentis is one of them, and Macugen. So that's a big issue in the ophthalmology, in the retina community, because what's happening is that a lot of retina specialists are using Avastin, or like Christy said, giving the choice of which one does the patient want to use, because Avastin is cheaper, but it works just as well. The issue is that they don't formulate Avastin for the eye, so it has to be formulated by either the doctor or the pharmacy, and that increases the risk of infection with it. So the similar compounds have an extremely low risk of infection, and Avastin has a slightly higher risk of infection. It's still really, really low, but it's higher than the other ones. So at this point, so the FDA is able to use those studies and say, we're not going to use Avastin because there's higher risk of infection, even though it's just because of the formulation. That was probably more than you wanted to know, but...
No, it's great.
Yeah, it's a huge difference.
Okay. And many of us work in the field of rehabilitation, and now and then, rarely, we have a client that we are fairly certain is lingering. Mm-hmm. Are there ways to test vision that are completely objective, where mm-hmm. you would be able, minus maybe hooking the brain mm-hmm. To be able to determine that a person is actually not reporting accurately?
Yeah, that's a problem in the eye world just in general. I mean, it's a problem in both worlds, in rehabilitation and in the eye world. A side story, but I work with a physical therapist. I'm doing research with her, and I went to a meeting to learn about a piece of equipment that they use in physical therapy, and they talked about how useful this piece of machinery is. It's for malingerers because of other problems, because of balance issues and workman's comp and things like that. So in rehab, and in eye worlds, there's malingering is an issue. There's a number of different ways that we can test malingerers, depending on their, what they're malingering about, what their ages are, things like that. And we can actually hook up their brains and use some machines that will test. They do have to agree to it, but it's very simple things. You can just put a couple of electrodes on the back of the head and have the patient. They don't say anything. They don't do anything. All they do is keep their eyes open, look at a screen, and it will measure how well the brain sees it and how good their acuity should be. And a lot of times it just takes talking to the patient. I've had a couple patients that I've had to talk to and convince them not to malinger. I can see that your retina is intact. You should be able to see better than this. So sometimes it just takes education to get malingerers to understand what's going on. It's very, in my perception, outside of kids trying to get glasses and things like that, it's very rare for somebody to be completely normal-sighted and try to fake that they have a visual impairment. Usually what it is that they're impaired, but they're trying to make it seem worse, is what I've experienced. And you might have different experiences, but so I find usually just educating them that, yes, you do have an impairment, it's just not as bad as you're making it out to be.
I have a question about my situation. I am totally blind, yet I see, and I have prosthetic eyes, yet I seem to pick up on light. And it just amazes me. When I had my eyes in, I would pick up on these pinpoints of light, and it's still happening.
So you have, both eyes are prosthetic?
Yes.
So you have no light perception, you have complete blindness measurably?
Yes.
So what's happening is that your brain is just getting stimulated somehow on its own. Has anybody ever heard of the condition Charles Bonnet syndrome? It's a similar type condition. It happens most of the time in people that do have some vision, but their vision is impaired. And in Charles Bonnet syndrome, the connections to the brain are still there, but the connections within the eye are not working right. So people with Charles Bonnet syndrome will see these really fantastical images. People have described, one of my patients saw a tiger on his bed. Another one saw little dancing girls that would just dance. And somebody else saw flowers on the wall, like it was a flowered wallpaper, but it wasn't. So people see these interesting things. And it's not a true hallucination because they're very conscious of the fact that they shouldn't see this. So I think probably what you're experiencing is something similar to that, where there's for some reason your brain centers that are for the eye are getting stimulated. Yeah. So interesting. Well, there's been a lot of studies on completely blind people and looking at different levels, whether they've had some vision versus being completely blind from birth. And they can do, specific kinds of MRIs. And they find that the visual centers, even in people that are completely blind, still are working. So they can still be stimulated. So people use their visual centers even without vision. They just use them differently. And the connections are more just making sense of things. Like you probably understand what colors are, even though you don't see them. And it's because your brain centers still work the same way, even without having that visual input.
I had two interesting cases back in 1992 when I came to the rehab. I had a person who, all the medical records indicated that she could see, and our medical consultant said she just doesn't qualify. But when I worked with her, it was obvious that she had a visual impairment. I talked to my supervisor, and he said, well, should she look like a duck, walk like a duck, and quack like a duck? And I said, yeah. He says, well, we have to help her. And it was interesting because when I gave her a mobility lesson, she really could not do well. And what had happened, she had a really traumatic impact when her husband died. It just impacted her so much that she became historically blind from the whole situation. Yeah, yeah. The other one was a person who was a truck driver. It was the same situation. Well, not same situation. He had been rear-ended by another big rig, and he had back neck injury, and it also affected his optic nerve, apparently, because when, again, they measured his eye, they said he could see, and his wife says he can't. We battled Social Security on that one for a long time, but we finally had to do a neurological evaluation on him, and he was blind, but his eye functioned. His everything seemed to work fine.
Yeah, the brain is a very interesting machine, and there's been a lot of new things that are coming out with people with brain injuries, whether it's because of trauma, and the war is really what's kind of highlighted a lot of this, is because the veterans are coming back with different kinds of injuries now because of the change in how wars are conducted. But also people from other injuries to the brain, like a stroke or a tumor or things like that. So what happens is people that have some kind of an injury to their brain might, everything looks normal, but they don't function normally. And I'm sure you guys have other, you know, victims of accidents or things like that that come in and have very strange appearances, but everything tests like it should be normal. So there's a lot of new... clinically new developments in this area to look at how we can evaluate people that have injuries like this and what to do about them, how to treat them so that they can be function better. It's kind of a separate arm from low vision, but very related. It's called neurooptometric rehabilitation, and we work together a lot. So I've been seeing a patient who also is seen by the neurooptometric rehab doctor. And he was a police officer that is out of the force. Now he's out of the force because of an injury when he was on the force. He was, I think he was shot and then beaten. And so he has a visual impairment, that's for sure. So I've been working with him on improving his functional vision because of the impairment. And then he also works with the neurooptometric doctor because he has trouble having his eyes work together and scanning and things like that. And she works with him on those tasks. And I found that since I saw him after he had been working with her for a couple weeks, and then he was doing home therapy and then came to me, and his vision significantly improved with the therapy. He still was impaired, but, you know, it was a lot, much better level of vision than he had had previously. So there's a lot of new work in this area. So it looks like we went over time. Do we have more time for questions or...
Our second speaker is not going to make it for personal reasons that he couldn't do that. So, yes, anybody else have any questions? Or we are... Go ahead.
With the cortical blindness condition, we had a client similar to the situation that Ed was talking about, where on paper the gentleman saw, but due to an injury to the back of the head, he didn't process what he was seeing. The eyes were fine. It was the processing of the brain that did not work. And there was a huge amount of anxiety for this man because he knew he saw, but he didn't make sense of what he saw. Mm-hmm. And is there research? It sounds like something similar to what you folks are doing in the neural area with the veterans. Are they looking at how that works and how that can be treated?
Yeah, they are. What's happening to the veterans, you know, as unfortunate as it is, it's really created a lot more knowledge that there are these kinds of impairments. So there's a lot more interest and funding going to these areas, and they're not all looking at specifically war injuries. But even war injuries can cause cortical blindness, so, you know, depending on how the injury happens. So there's a lot of research into, and people clinically, cortical blindness has always been an interesting thing because there's thought that there should be ways to improve it, because you're right, people know they can see, but they can't process their vision. So there should be ways to be able to rehabilitate the brain to understand that a little bit more. But I'm not entirely aware of what exactly for cortical blindness is happening in the literature.
Is it the similar process that manifests when someone on those rare occasions that did see when they were very young and then loses vision and goes total and then many years later gets some treatment that gives them back a significant part of vision, but now they still can't process it. Mm-hmm. Is that a similar process to the cortical blindness injury?
Yeah, and that's, it brings up another just very unique thought of sight restoration and all of the research into, retinal implants and things like that. And they're very tricky. I don't know how much you guys have heard about some of those implants, but people will, they have the ability to improve vision, but it's not great. It's really just being able to see shadows. Exactly, and it's oftentimes very difficult for those people to go from no vision to seeing a little bit because it's so different, and it's just going backwards. It's going, instead of adapting to losing vision, it's adapting to regaining vision. But particularly for people that have had vision in the past, they know, a lot of them know this is not normal and it's not quite right. So it's a very tricky subject. It's, it sounds great, but there's a lot that's involved with it.
So no more TV and movie stuff.
Yeah. But some of them are, I think that some of the movies somewhat accurately portray the difficulties with visual impairment. There was the one with Val Kilmer. And that seems to me to be similar to what I've heard reports of with people having difficulty regaining vision back. Okay, next question.
Given that, there's a lot of people, the baby boomers getting older and all, and different eye conditions, just coming up. Back to print and how we use it in our society. I know me personally, I can't explain with a lady I work with why it is that when I make appointments that for me to be able to read the material in the appointment book, the stuff that's written by hand, she doesn't understand how it is that her writing in block letters, I don't care how big she makes it, I can't read it. But if it's doesn't have serifs and it's roundish or whatever, it's still easier to read. And is that a common thing, or is it maybe more something of me? And how are we looking at, say, street signs and different ways of presenting print besides just getting larger as the generations get older?
Well, there's a couple... a couple different points that you have in there. I think that the change in technology and huge increase in technology over the years is really going to help things, because a lot of people are moving on to using computers, and so information is on the computer. It's easily modifiable. You can change the font quickly and easily. And also you can print things, and then you can read it on paper the way that works best for you with the type of format that you like it, as opposed to having to rely on someone else's handwriting. In ways sometimes that makes things a little bit different, because people use technology to get fancy, and so they might try to use fancier scripts and things like that. So sometimes it's harder to, it might make things harder, but in general, there's so many new technologies that can make print easier to read, or can even make it auditory so that people can hear it instead. Yeah, I think it's a personal preference. And in general, for most people, block letters work better. And also another point is that there are some people that use all caps for people that are visually impaired, but they think that that's helpful, but it's really not. You lose a lot of information when you use all caps versus capital and lowercase letters. But there are other technologies. There's, I'm trying to remember, my mom works in the area of special ed, and so she uses this pen, and I don't remember the name of it. Does anybody know the pen that it will record what you write, and then you can plug it into the computer? If you have a card, I can... What's it called? And I saw it, my mom uses it for so many of her students... It's an actual pen. So what my mom's students use it for is they'll take notes in class, and then it will kind of record where they stop, where they start, and then it can convert it to text on a computer. And I've seen it at Best Buy, so I know they sell it. It's not terribly cheap. It's like $150 or something, but. Mm-hmm. Right, I think so. Let me, yeah, look into it, or if you give me your card, I'll look into it, because I keep it in the back of my mind for some of my patients, but I haven't used it yet for anyone.
Also, go online and see if Independent Living Aid has it, or LS&S has it, because I think I saw it at ILA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does it actually write?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Oh, handwriting's tough. Everybody has a different style.
Right.
Are there any other questions? Okay. I want to thank Dr. Napier, but I'd like the students to say their name again for ACB Radio Stream and what year they're in.
Hi, I'm Andrew, and I'm a third-year optometry student at Western University.
And I'm Sabrina, and I'm a third-year student at Western University.
Western University's in Pomona. And it's free, Pomona, California. Uh-huh. And it's right off the Metrolink if you want to get to them by Metrolink. And it's also in, what's the name of that? It's not Second Street, but the next street, Gary. Yeah.
But our clinic is on Town.
On Town, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a wonderful place if you ever need to have optometric evaluation, go there. It's really, they do a very thorough examination. Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a wonderful campus. I like the sculpture that they have outside. When I first got there, I saw somebody painting the walls walking by. That guy's not moving, but what's going on? My assistant said, "Ed, that's a sculpture." And I said, "Oh, well." That's what happens when you're legally blind. You can't see the detail. But this...
We don't have any handouts, but I can prepare some and give them to Ed if you guys would be interested.
Yeah, I could.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we'll do something electronic. I'll email it to Ed and then... Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for those who are out on ACB Radio Stream, please contact Donna Brown, Pomerantz, Donna Pomerantz, and let her know if this was something that was of interest. Thought this would be a different twist on what we do, and this is informative, and I'd like to do more educational presentations like this. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you all for having us.
My daughter's